What if we did that on purpose? What if I did that on purpose? What if I got up every day and my goal was to give God my career in such a way that every song that I wrote was something that he could use in a real life, rubber meets the road, when it really matters kind of way? And that's where Music for the Soul came from, just from a general discontent that the surface level love, mercy, grace, hope, peace songs we were writing, they just weren't going deep enough. There's sort of a just believe in Jesus and everything will be okay kind of, you know, mode to all of that, that I think stops short of just how precious and valuable and life-changing the love of Jesus really is.
You're listening to Restoring the Soul with Michael John Cusick. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 4. I'm Michael John Cusick. My guest today is Steve Seiler. After a long stretch in Los Angeles, where Steve wrote music for television and other media groups, he eventually wrote a secular top 40 hit. While listening to that song on the radio, he immediately asked himself, "Is this all there is?" A short time later, he moved to Nashville, where he wrote songs for Christian artists, winning 4 Dove Awards, 9 number one singles, and Song of the Year in 2000. But Steve still had a dream that had nothing to do with his songs on the radio or plaques on the wall. The dream? To start an organization that would write songs speaking hope to people living in deep pain, songs that would open doors of healing for the walking wounded. In short, to sing songs about the things that are hard to talk about. So Steve walked away from his job as a staff songwriter at a major Nashville record company, and he launched Music for the Soul, a nonprofit ministry that creates projects speaking to some of life's most difficult issues. Steve Seiler, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Looking forward to talking to you today about Music for the Soul, the organization that you started. But first, I want to talk a little bit about your prolific background as a songwriter. When did you first know that you wanted to be a songwriter?
Well, I think I first knew that I wanted that to be my profession probably when I was about 16, 17, somewhere in there. I'd always been a guitar player up until then, always. At that point, about 8 or 9 years, I'd been a guitar player. And I'd written already hundreds of songs, you know, with friends and bands in school as a hobby, what have you. But at the point that I realized I thought I wanted to do it more seriously, I asked my parents for a piano, because I realized if I was going to attempt to make a career out of this, that I needed to understand the harmonics better and I needed to be more versatile. And I felt like understanding and playing the piano would help with that. So I think I got that piano for my 18th birthday. So I'd say right around then was when I kind of dove in.
And when you were writing those songs with your friends and doing bands and stuff, who were some of your early influences?
Oh, well, without a doubt, it all began with the Beatles, which I like to say makes me as unique as a grain of sand on the beach. I mean, you know, they changed everything. And what particularly attracted me to them, though, was not that they were musicians, but that they were writers. And so it's an interesting – the two albums that got me most interested in songwriting were Meet the Beatles and Mary Poppins.
Wow.
And that might sound kind of funny, but I think the Mary Poppins soundtrack is one of the most well-written in terms of the songs and the content, and that inspired me tremendously. And then, of course, Meet the Beatles and seeing them in Ed Sullivan and going, hey, all those girls seem to really like these guys. I think I'd like to do that.
I'm literally about halfway through Springsteen's new novel, Born to Run, which is surprisingly tender and in-depth and very, very well written. He apparently took 7 years to write that book. But he has a chapter in there called The Big Bang. And despite it being a rock and roll memoir, it's not what you think. It's actually the moment he describes of watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. And he said that was when his world was recreated. So what is it about the Beatles that they were songwriters and not just performers? Help me understand that.
The difference between being writers and performers, I think, is a singer you know, can hear a song and say, oh, that really expresses, you know, who I am and who I want to be. And they can sing that song and they can add to it, add their take on it. But when you're a writer, for me, the joy has always been, if I'm a writer, I don't have to be the artist too. So, you know, on a Monday, I can write a folk song, and on a Tuesday, I can write a rock song, and on a Wednesday, I can write a kid song, and so on. So as a writer, I have the opportunity and the option to zig and zag and to express all of my musical personalities, whereas artists, you know, they sort of get trapped into a persona, especially if they become successful. You know, if you're Neil Diamond, you have to sing the kind of songs that the Neil Diamond fans expect you to sing. The artists that don't do that find their careers waning pretty quickly. And so I've always enjoyed being a writer, because as a writer, you're rather anonymous. And your success is not dependent on staying married to any one particular style.
And it sounds like in some ways, tell me if you're not saying this, but that you can be more creative not having to perform the songs you're writing.
Well, absolutely, because as a performer, you get into a box. Now, some of those boxes can be really good and last a really long time. And if there's a particular style that really feeds you, maybe that can even be something that you enjoy. But as a writer, I'm just not hemmed in by any expectations from my audience this is Steve, so he's got to be, you know, a rock and roller all the time, or he's got to be, you know, a classically trained Andrea Bocelli type singer all the time. It doesn't matter. I've written everything from the classical stuff to kids stuff to game show themes to worship songs. You know, I mean, it just doesn't matter. And as a writer, I love that the palette, you know, is literally the canvas, I guess, is the more accurate word. The canvas is as large or as small or as I want it to be.
So game show themes. Did you write the theme song from Jeopardy? Do, 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 do.
You know what? I really wish I had. I actually believe Merv Griffin, who created the show, wrote the theme as well. So he was kind of a threat on many levels. I wrote my biggest success as a game show theme writer was a show called Fun House. And here's the funny thing. When I wrote Funhouse, it was a writer for hire kind of situation. So I got one check to write it. It wound up paying for my wife and I to go on a three week tour of New England in the fall, bed and breakfast. It was fabulous. But I was so ashamed of the show itself, which it was basically a show where kids like slimed each other.
That I remember that. I was trying to go through my mind. I'm thinking about that.
Yeah. So I'm at a friend's house in Portland, Oregon, and it's actually this lady. I was working on some stuff for abused kids with her, you know, to help abused children. And they had the TV on, and Funhouse came on the TV. And it's so funny because, of course, she didn't know I'd written that. But I found myself deliberately angling myself so that I blocked the television screen. It's like subconsciously I wanted that to not intrude on this, you know, serious relationship that I was developing, you know, to do this serious work. So it's pretty funny because I literally was ashamed of it to the point of not wanting it to be like on in the room.
And I've heard other artists speak of seasons in their life where they're, to use your word, ashamed of something they have done in the past. And is that common? And is there other stuff that you go, oh, my gosh, you know, I'm embarrassed about that in the past?
Oh, absolutely. There's a story in my book where I talk about it was a very important moment for me. I wanted to be a songwriter so badly. I wanted to be paid to write something so badly that I actually accepted an assignment to write the theme song for the opening of a male strip club in London. And I aced the job, did a really, really good job with the song. They used it. But almost immediately thereafter, I found myself just saying, you know, what kind of a Christian has so little faith that he thinks that to achieve his dream, he has to forego all of his morality, all of his ethics, and write something that he doesn't believe in. And that's what I had done. I had been so desperate to be validated as a songwriter that I went against everything else I stood for. And I think God, you know, we talk about how God can use everything. I think God used that and the fact that I said yes to that opportunity to really make me search my heart about what do I really want to do with the rest of my life. And it's not lost on me that somebody who wrote the theme song to, you know, a Chippendales grand opening later on wound up producing Somebody's Daughter, A Journey to Freedom from Pornography. You know, for me, I won't say that was like penance or anything, but I certainly did feel later on as I realized that that was the case, felt like God's grace in permitting me to be the producer of that project and to come back around and say, no, this is what my art is intended for. And to have the opportunity to do that and to make amends, I just thought was God's grace, in full display.
Wow, that is a beautiful redemptive irony.
Mm-hmm. Sure is.
So, Steve, you worked as a songwriter for many, many years, and I want to get to the transition that led you to Music for the Soul. But tell me a little bit more about some of the other areas that you wrote for. You mentioned that you had written for a game show. Did you write jingles? Did you write for movies?
Well, originally, I did want to be the artist way, way, way back when. And I got to play the Hollywood Bowl and the Troubadour and some pretty nice venues in Los Angeles. And I had a lot of friends who were very, very talented. And some of them went on to successful music careers in their own right. And so I was pursuing the artist thing. And somewhere along the way, I just, you know, I sort of got tired of banging my head against that wall and thought, well, maybe my road in is to, you know, do more songwriting and not worry so much about the artist thing. And, but that wasn't going exactly swimmingly well either. and then a friend of mine, a high school buddy of mine, was hired to play bass on a game, on a TV show taping. And the music supervisor, he and she got to be kind of good friends. And he said, I've got a friend who writes music that I think would be really good at writing some music for your TV programs. And so she and I met, and that was the beginning of a relationship with a New York-based company called Score Productions. And I wrote music of all varieties for them. And it was a really great training ground for me because I eventually would become a staff songwriter later on. And the great thing about being affiliated with Score Productions is that every week they were calling me to write something completely different. It might be a soap opera a love scene. It might be, the game show thing we talked about. It was just all different kinds of music cues, Wide World of Sports. I mean, so I was challenged to write music in a variety of styles, and I did that for 4 or 5 years. And so during that time, I was still trying to get individual songs recorded, and I finally did have my first quote-unquote hit on the radio. And that was actually the moment, Michael, when I realized that I wasn't doing what God had called me to do. Because I heard the song on the radio and I thought, okay, this is what I've worked for my entire life, right? And when I heard it, I just felt like, so that's it, huh? And I realized in that moment that there was really nothing of me in the song, that I was aping the culture, giving them what I thought they wanted, and that what I had written was utterly forgettable, that it didn't matter to me. And if it didn't matter to me, it probably wasn't going to ultimately matter to anybody else. And it was that hit song that drove me into the church late that night to pray and ask God, what do you want me to do with this gift you've given me? Because I'm pretty sure that what I'm doing is not that.
And so what happened after you went into the church and prayed, and what happened?
Well, it's really, really remarkable because it doesn't seem like it should be this easy. But by that time, I think I was like 31. So I'd been going down the musically, I won't say the wrong path. I'd been learning, certainly, but I'd been going down this path for like 13 years. And so once I actually asked God, hey, what do you think I should be doing? it was as if, well, I thought you'd never ask, right? Because almost immediately everything changed. And once I realized that I wanted to to honor God with my work, my prayer became, you know, let my work reflect the healing and compassion of Christ. And once I came up with that mission statement for my career and my life, the opportunities just started coming fast and furious. I got a call about 2 weeks after that prayer in the church from somebody I did not know. He had come and visited our church on a day when I had sung for the first time ever one of my three Christian songs that I'd written in my life. I played that day. He called me up and asked me if I would write the music for a play that he was working on for sexually abused children. Out of the blue. Never met the man, didn't know the man. So I accepted that assignment. I got a call from another friend who asked me if I would write a song for an AIDS fundraiser she was doing because her best friend was dying of AIDS. I accepted that assignment. Basically, every opportunity that started coming to me from that point on was an opportunity that reflected my life statement, my vision statement for my life. And if it didn't, then it was really easy to say, that's not my opportunity. Thank you, but no.
And were you still living in L.A. at that time?
I was. I was living in Los Angeles. We didn't move to Nashville for about another 3 years after that. We moved to Nashville in 93.
So what was that remaining time like in L.A.? Was that kind of what stirred up the need to be more in the world of contemporary Christian music?
I had no desire to be in the world of contemporary Christian music, honestly, at that time. I wasn't really actively seeking that. I'd sent like one tape and one letter to one company. And it was what was funny is that that company sent me a polite rejection letter. And then a few years later, I was sitting at a table in Nashville and the exact same lady asked me to come and be a staff writer for her company. So, it's funny how things work out. But my time in Los Angeles, those remaining years in Los Angeles were entirely devoted to the project for sexually abused kids. We recorded a full-length album project, and we toured the stage play to colleges, elementary schools, churches, all over the place for 3 years. And when we moved to Nashville, we did not know, you know, what we were going to be doing. Neither of us had a job. Neither of us really had any connections. We just felt like we were being called out of Los Angeles and to Nashville. And when I got to Nashville, that song that I told you about, the AIDS song that I'd written, had wound up being recorded by Patty Austin. And she had sung it at the quilt ceremony in D.C., and they released an album, GRP Records, called We're All in This Together, which is the name of the song. And I walked into Tower Records the first week I was in Nashville, and it was We're All in This Together week, or month, actually. We're All in This Together month at Tower Records. I had not known any of this was going on. And when I went for my first potential publishing meeting, and they found out I wrote that song, they offered me a publishing deal on the spot. I'd been in town about 10 days.
Wow.
It just doesn't happen.
Yeah. And I know you're a humble guy, so you may downplay this, but you were very, very successful in Nashville. You won multiple Dove Awards. You had, I think, 9 number one singles on the CCM charts. You wrote nearly 50 top 10 Christian songs, and your songs have been recorded by many, many different folks in the contemporary Christian music industry. But with all that success, what started to stir in your heart that you decided to, in one sense, walk away from that and start this nonprofit ministry, Music for the Soul?
Well, I want to answer carefully here because it's going to sound like I'm ripping on the CCM industry. And, you know, there are so many people within that industry that I love deeply, artists, producers, singers, musicians. It's just fabulous, a fabulous group of people. But I'm sure you've heard the slogan. One of the stations says that their station is safe for the whole family. And I really think that's a low bar for us as Christians to make things safe for everybody. I don't think Jesus was terribly concerned with us living safe lives. Saved lives Yes, safe lives, no. And I think that once you have a relationship with Christ, and if you're seriously trying to follow Christ, that you're going to be called into some really difficult and challenging places, because it's that it's there where the light is needed. The light is needed in the darkness. So, you know, I was being asked to write these songs, basically put words in the mouths of other folks. And for a while, that was really, you know, it was fun to be a, I mean, I'm not going to lie, it was fun to be a hit songwriter. It was fun to win awards and to have people care about what you were doing. But I really felt like, you know, this one recording artist came in to meet with me to write songs for his new album. And I said, you know, what's on your heart? What's God been teaching you? What do you want to share with your audience? And he literally replied, I don't care just so long as it's cool. And that was sort of the moment where I said, okay, I think I've said all I've got to say to this particular audience. You know, so I was just feeling like I just was aware of so many issues, of so many difficult things that people were going through, that I felt like we could be singing about and we could be speaking to. And every once in a while, it was happening, you know, where God would take a song that I'd written for a recording artist and would pull it out of context and use it somewhere else. That happened with my song Not Too Far From Here that had been a number one for Kim Boyce. It wound up being sung at the memorial service for the families of the Murrah Federal bombing in Oklahoma City. So that was a chance for me to see that God had taken a song of mine outside the narrow confines of CCM and used it to bless people in a real life situation. And when I saw that, I thought, what if we did that on purpose? What if I did that on purpose? What if I got up every day and my goal was to give God my career in such a ways that every song that I wrote was something that he could use in a real life, rubber meets the road when it really matters kind of way? And that's where Music for the Soul came from, just from a general discontent that the surface level love, mercy, grace, hope, peace songs we were writing, they just weren't going deep enough. There's sort of a just believe in Jesus and everything will be okay kind of, you know, mode to all of that, that I think stops short of just how precious and valuable and life-changing the love of Jesus really is.
Yeah, I have a number of friends, some of whom you know, as mutual friends in Nashville, who have spoken about how contemporary Christian music has too many happy endings and mm-hmm. how it doesn't live in that tension mm-hmm. between the tension between the good news and the reality of life. Yes. And this is, I want to transition just in our last few minutes here, because I want to play a song to talk about how Music for the Soul speaks to the reality of life. What is the mission of Music for the Soul?
To speak through song with the hope and healing and compassion of Christ to people who are in life's most difficult circumstances so that they can be free.
And how many different projects have you guys completed?
Oh, gosh, more than a dozen. Some of them are full-length albums. I know the phrase album is from yesteryear. I apologize to your younger listeners. We call them projects now, or resources. But we also have done several – we've done several single-song projects. We've done videos. We've done I'd say probably 8 full-length projects. By that, I mean 10 songs or more. And on a variety of topics, we've done stuff for young women with eating disorders. We've done a project for people with who are grieving a suicide. We've done somebody's daughter that I already referred to for folks struggling with pornography. We've done a piece called Dignity for people caring for a loved one in the home. Drink Deep for grief, Hold on the Side of God for special needs families. Our newest project, which will be coming out in just a couple of months, is called Mercy Great Enough, and it's for folks who have guilt or shame over an abortion decision in their past. So just a wide variety of projects touching on some of the most difficult stories that people have lived.
So, Steve, I want to go to our break of episode one, playing a song, and it's off the album called Chaos of the Heart, which is for individuals who have lost a loved one through suicide, a very, very difficult topic. But I think this will give listeners a great picture of how Music for the Soul addresses these unbelievably hard life issues with music that's neither cheesy nor patronizing with simple answers. So here's Chaos of the Heart from the album of the same name. Welcome back. Steve, any comments or commentary on that song, Chaos of the Heart?
Well, I think it reflects well something that we're able to do as a Christian nonprofit ministry, not seeking to get radio airplay. That song doesn't try to fix anything. All that song does is says, we see you. We know how you feel. You're not alone. God sees you. God cares. But it doesn't say, and if you'll just do this, it'll all be okay. It just acknowledges the pain, the tension, which is the word you used earlier, the fact that you can love someone and hate them at the same time. it just makes a real statement about what it feels like to be in such an untenable emotional place.
You've been listening to another episode of Restoring the Soul. Learn more about how we cultivate freedom and wholeness of heart at restoringthesoul.com.